Even now, when we have this right-wing candidate, Nicu Șordan, and the extreme right candidate, George Simion, both of them and the other political actors and intellectuals and media suggest us that there is no alternative. There's no third alternative to these two. So you have to choose either a right-wing neoliberal policymaker or an extremist who will also make the cuts which will be necessary, who will also spend money for militarization because that's a must in the European Union.
Hello everyone, welcome back to BungaCast, the global politics podcast at the end of the end of history. I'm Alex Hokili in São Paulo, Brazil, and today I'm speaking to Enrique Vince, whose name I hope I've pronounced correctly, welcome, who is joining us from where exactly in Romania?
Hi, hello to everyone. Thank you for your invitation. I'm located in Cluj, Napoca, Colojvar, so the Transylvania region of Romania.
Okay, excellent. And Enrico is an academic at Babes Bolyai University and is an activist in the movement called Social Housing Now, which is an aspect we will touch on as we go through this. As listeners have probably gathered by now, this is an episode about Romania, and most people who will have read something about Romania in the news in recent times will probably have heard about it because of the annulled elections back in December. This is a matter that we've touched upon here and there over recent months, but I'm happy to be able to finally do a dedicated episode on Romania to talk both about the politics around that election, the election which has just been held last week, and which we will see the second round of this weekend. We're recording this on Monday, the 12th of May. You'll be hearing this as of tomorrow. So I think to get started, there's been a lot of discussion about, well, themes that have become very common across the world, those of lawfare, misinformation, contested elections, and so on. So let's start there. In Romania's election back in December, there were the by now quite familiar accusations of Russian interference to help a right-wing populist and an establishment attempt to annul those elections, which was ultimately successful. So could you tell us exactly what happened?
Many things happened since then. So it's a very intense story, I guess. To recall what happened at the end of last November, actually, was, as you said, the first round of presidential elections in Romania. And those elections happened in parallel with the Romanian parliament elections. Actually, last year, we had four elections back in June, the local and the Euro Parliament. So I guess each political party was very energized and full for with promises and also non-transparency regarding the real economic and geopolitical issues that affect Romania. And I guess the major political parties, which were on the government priorly, actually hoped that they did everything to keep a social peace, you know, around the geopolitical matters, cost of living matters, austerity measures that willingly or not, they had to start actually after the parliamentary elections. So what I want to suggest with this, that the atmosphere was very heavy with on one hand the day by day economic material issues of the population and the hopes of the leading political parties, which are Social Democrat Party, the National Liberal Party, and the Hungarian Democratic Association, who actually, three of them formed a national coalition for Romania after the, and even prior to last year's elections. So again, they very hoped, and at the, you know, the results of the parliament elections could have been promising for them. So it was like a usual way to get number of votes, percentages of votes. And these three parties actually considered that their candidates for the presidency will get a similar amount and percentage of votes. But that did not happen, actually, because this surprise candidate called Călin Georgescu, an independent, turned upside down the whole political spectrum. He got almost 23% of votes. So all the other candidates of this big traditional historical parties lost a lot. And then immediately the losers actually started to try to explain why did this happen, you know. Mm. And they made appeal to anything, but not to the economic problems of the population, which were not only occurred during last year or in the past 2-3 years, but during the, 30 decades of capitalist transformations. So, and they started to speak about, the fraudulent way in which Georgescu was supposedly supported by TikTok campaigns. So they transformed this political crisis into a, you know, digital technology issue. And, even more, the security bodies of the state declared for a sudden that they have proofs for the interference of another state into the elections. However, before the first round of the election, they said that there is no such a threat in Romania. Mm. But suddenly, yes, this became the major mainstream explanation for the success of Georgescu. And 2 days before the second round of the elections, the Central Electoral Bureau decided to annul the elections, and the Constitutional Court re-emphasized this.
There's a lot there already, and we're going to work through the politics of it before turning to some of the geopolitics, to the war in Ukraine, and then we'll finish off by talking about state economy and society. But to return specifically to the politics, I mean, just so that we're on the same page, and if I've understood correctly, you've got these mainstream parties, which is the main pillars of which are the Social Democrats. You've got a more center-right neoliberal, explicitly neoliberal party, and then you've got a kind of Hungarian minority party. And then what has happened at the elections has been this radical right or far right, I don't know exactly how you'd characterize this force, but this party which has kind of come out of nowhere to win the last election, or to make it into the second round of the election last December. And now basically a similar thing has happened just this past week, right? The redo of the first round, which has just happened, did that kind of take a similar shape to what the annulled first round did?
Many coalitions, alliances were disrupted when the elections were restarted in March. So a week ago, right? So what happened was that the candidate who got the second most votes in the first round and was supposed to go in the second round in December last year was actually replaced by the political party that supported her. So, and that was a very important move. And that political party is called United Save Romania, which withdrew its support from this woman. She was a female candidate. So that was a very important change. And then another important change was obviously the total disappearance of Georgescu from the candidates in early March. He presented his candidacy again, but again the electoral bureau and the constitutional court declared his application inappropriate. So he was excluded. And then instead of him, another candidate appeared, whose name is George Simeon, who actually is leading the Alliance for the Unification of Romania's party, AUR, and who actually claimed the fact that he is taking over the legacy of Georgescu. So he launched a kind of ambiguous and not very clear messages in this regard, because on the one hand, he claimed the retaken the second round of the elections, make justice in this sense for the Romanians who voted with Georgescu. But on the other hand, he announced his candidacy to be president. Okay, and the third big difference was the appearance on the candidacy list of an independent candidate. His name is Nicu Șordan. And, you know, I said the party which was beyond second positioned candidate in the last round, in the former round, actually switched to him and declared that USR, this is the United Save Romania party, will support Mr. Dan. So the whole spectrum changed, actually. And as a result of these changes, the fourth important change was that the so-called National Coalition for Romania, which was formed among the three big parties that we mentioned, the traditional historical Romanian political parties, the Social Democrats, National Liberals, and the Hungarian Party, actually withdrew their own candidates and designated a shared candidate, Crin Antonescu. And again, probably they hoped that having this shared candidate and enjoying the support of all the voters who in the past used to vote to these three parties, they will be able to gain a lot of votes, and this will bring them into the second round at least. But the surprise again happened, and this George Simeon, the AUR party, the extreme right party, gained 41% of votes. And Nicu Șordan, the independent candidacy with the support of an alliance of right-wing parties, got like 21% or so.
Mm.
So these are the two guys who entered into the second round.
I mean, this sounds quite a lot like, well, like it followed the populist script or the script that has been laid out between kind of the establishment and so-called populist or anti-system forces across Europe for the past decade or more. I saw reported that Simeon posted on X, formerly Twitter, on Friday that this election is not about one candidate or another, but about every Romanian who has been lied to, ignored, humiliated, and still has the strength to believe and defend our identity and rights. That sounds I guess like what you'd expect him to say. I mean, if you knew very little about Romania, but you knew that there had been an election and you knew that the establishment had kind of come together to force out this somewhat outsider candidate, that sort of line wouldn't come as a surprise to you to hear that. How much of an anti-system candidate is Simeon?
This is a very good question. And actually, a similar question could be put to Nicu Șordan as well, because they have some similar civic activist past, and this makes things to be more interesting.
But by civic activist, you mean they were campaigners for rights?
I mean, Simeon, active even in the Russia Montana protests, which were protests against gold mining Canadian gold mining corporation, and there they kind of work together at the moment with Nico Jordan, so the other civic activists. But afterwards, their activist paths somehow separated. So while Dan was campaigning against big corporations in Bucharest, the capital city of Romania, and for saving the patrimonial buildings of Bucharest, the historical buildings of Bucharest, while he was doing that, Simeon turned towards campaigning for the unification of Bessarabia with Romania. So a nationalist agenda, a nationalist civic activism, if you wish. And both of them at a point established a political party from their civil society organizations. And the political party of Simeon was established in 2019 for Europarliamentary elections, but he did not win by then. Nevertheless, the COVID pandemic, the whole public debates around vaccines, pro and against, the debates around restrictions regarding free movement of people during pandemic and regarding economic measures that were taken by that time actually made him a hero in the eye of all those people who did not want to get the vaccine and all those people who did not agree with restrictions. So actually his party became very strong during that period of time. So in a way, he was anti-system. Now, if the system imposed vaccination and restrictions, he claimed that he's anti-system. But yeah, now when we see his current political program, well, it's obvious that he is not an anti-system. If we consider that the system is the capitalist system, he just switches the emphasis on Romanian capital. And he presents himself as a promoter of Romanian entrepreneurs against foreign entrepreneurs, foreign investments, and foreign capital. So this goes very well with his nationalist agenda, obviously. Actually, what he does is to reproduce capitalism with a different face. So he's anti-system in the sense of being anti-globalization and hyper-globalization as we knew it in the past.
Until recently.
and he turns towards supporting Romanian capital, but still within capitalism. So he's not anti-system in this sense.
Yeah. I mean, are there figures across Europe or even in neighboring countries specifically to whom you would compare him? Does he have a kind of, you know, an equivalent? Is Orban a decent comparison to him? I don't know. Robert Fico, who's a figure that listeners to this podcast may be familiar with as well, because we did an episode on Slovakia towards the end of last year. Are there figures that we could compare him to?
Yeah, actually, he compares himself to Meloni. And he emphasizes that he considers that shares a lot of Meloni's ideas. And actually, when in 2024, so last year, he won and his party got enough votes to enter into the European Parliament, he became the vice president of the European Conservatives and Reformists. So the Meloni's political family, political party family in the parliament. So obviously, she is a model for him. All the ideology against same-sex marriage, same-sex parenting, anti-immigration, ideas of Christian Europe, even anti-Green Deal agreement, present in Simeon's political program as well. So he, yeah, in this sense, he's also close to Orban, Viktor, but as we know, more recently, Orban created another political family in the European Parliament, which is called Patriots for Europe. And we have also served structure for extreme right-wing Europarlamentarians, and that's called Europe of Sovereign Nations, right? So, but yeah, actually all these three political configurations are not against the EU, as they say, but are against the EU as it is today. So they want to reform the European Union. They actually want to go back in the history of the European Union before the Maastricht Treaty from 1993. So what they want simply is a group of nations, a European Union functioning as an economic community, not more. So
I mean, it's interesting.
So the mechanism that they actually claim, it's not a totally anti-globalist or isolationist or protectionist politics, but they have different ways to imagine how economic and trade collaboration should happen within the EU, respectively, with non-EU regions.
No, I mean, that's interesting.
Russia, China and US.
Yeah, I mean, it's interesting that you mentioned Meloni. I want to touch on this in just a second because I think that she's interesting insofar as she pioneers a much more conformist turn within right-wing national populist politics towards being, if not kind of forthrightly pro-EU, then certainly not Eurosceptic in the way that people in her political tradition have been, also being much more Atlanticist, pro-NATO, being much more fiscally conservative and so on. So I want to come to this in a second, especially when we come onto the kind of geopolitics. But just before that, I wanted to try to understand kind of who it is that is voting for AUR, who, you know, in terms of class and in geography, and then who also votes for the mainstream parties. What are the kind of dividing lines as they're reflected in electoral politics in Romania?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, there are both geographical and class differences, but this should be interpreted in a very nuanced way. So, like, for example, when we think about social classes, what kind of social class, who would vote for AUR, for example, who would vote for USR, or who would vote for the traditional parties? That's not so simple, because as I already said, Simeon claims to promote the Romanian honors. So the entrepreneurial class belonging to the capitalist ruling classes would presumably suppose him, or a part of this class of people. So it's not only the labor classes or the most precarious laborers who would support him because he promises something totally new, right? And he promises dignity, he promises a national renaissance, he promises the recognition of religious beliefs, orthodoxy, most importantly. So, yes, maybe it's a very specific configuration of people positioned in different social classes could actually vote for him. Geographically speaking, it is the rural areas mostly and small towns of Romania which knew a very intense and continuous economic degradation, depopulation due to the emigration abroad. So we have like 4 million Romanians working abroad. And those who remained, well, actually they have a very low level of quality of life. So it's not surprising that after 35 years, they will not vote anymore the Social Democrats, whom they usually voted, because the Social Democrats somehow did not fulfill the promises. Actually, they were also responsible for all the privatization and liberalization process. So they kind of implemented neoliberal policies, if you wish, in the economy. And so it's like this. And then we have the Bucharest, the capital city, and the regional city. So Romania is quite a big country, as you know. And there are several regional inequalities between its different territories. But each region actually has one regional city center, you know, where economic growth was more visible in the past 20 years, at least since 2000, after the stabilization, after all the privatization and other processes. So the big urban areas where there is a lot of foreign investment, which is actually the base of economic growth in Romania, where there are jobs, where there are universities, where people with higher salaries afford to live. So actually, this is the social strata which voted for Nicu Șordan, the USR, right? So it's... but at the end of the day, both camps voted against the Social Democrats, partially also against the National Liberal Party, but that is not so obvious because USR and other liberal parties are forming actually a coalition of liberal parties. So the promises of liberalism and neoliberalism somehow still survived among the voters of Nicu Șordan. So,
I mean, is it like a polarization between kind of a more centrist populism and supposedly more outsider populism, but both in some ways of the two candidates who made it to the runoff now, both of them present in some ways as being... in some ways, outsiders, as you mentioned, they've had this, each has this history in kind of civic activism and so on.
Mm-hmm. And each of them promises a kind of moral solutions for solving economic issues. So both of them, because they are so-called anti-systemic, because they are anti-establishment, political establishment, actually, they recognize that there are a lot of social divisions, polarization in Romania. But I don't know, very strangely, both of them consider that these divisions are, I don't know, occurred suddenly during the... they don't have economic causes, structural causes. Capitalism is okay, is the best and only alternative that we can know and we should want for us, and they establish these new moral fundaments for they want to establish some new moral values for the whole society. And for Nicu Șordan, the central moral value is honesty, and for Simeon is respect. So actually they expect that these key terms will actually mobilize those people who feel betrayed by the former dominant establishment mainstream parties.
Excellent. Okay, so let's turn to geopolitics. I think it's something that we can't ignore. What's been the impact of the Ukrainian war on Romanian politics? Obviously, the establishment was frightened, taken aback by Georgescu's success in December, which really came out of nowhere. From my understanding, he was polling maybe in the single digits or low double digits and went on to make it into the runoff. Then the election was annulled. The accusation there was that he had benefited from some last minute spending on TikTok advertisements, paid for by Russia, something like that. So that gives at least the impression that Romanian politics is polarized between a kind of pro-Russian side and a pro-Brussels side, you know, polarized between Moscow and Brussels. Is that representative at all of what is going on and the state of the debate over politics in Romania?
Mm-hmm. Well, maybe we stay and stress the case of these two candidates. Maybe this will be more simple and shorter to discuss. Simeon is blamed and stigmatized of being pro-Russian, but in his speeches he emphasizes that he actually is not, and he is pro-European, as I already said, but he wants another kind of European Union. He is against the Western values of progressive culture, like LGBTQ communities, feminism, and so on and so forth. And what he also declared was recently that he considered that Russia is not such a big threat to Romania. Actually, this is an argument that we heard from other parts as well, that the construction of Russia as the biggest threat to Europe is actually a tool to justify militarization. And Russia doesn't really have the capacity to conquer any European countries. He couldn't conquer Ukraine as well, neither. Sorry. And he says that the threat is the decreasing influence of NATO in Romania. So he's pro-NATO, in a way anti-European army stuff. So he balances between pro here, against there, and vice versa.
But my understanding was Georgescu was more explicitly anti-NATO, right?
He was more explicit at a point, but then he also withdrew his very sharp anti-NATO, anti-European discourse. Yeah, but, you know, but still the perception of this antagonism is present. So it's a very widespread way to blame those who criticize the European Union, who criticize militarization. It's a very usual way to silence them by saying that they are pro-Russian, they are pro-Putin, they are pro-authoritarian regime. So it's, as a political perception, has a very important role, this dichotomy. And I just read today another, if you wish, foreign intervention into the elections, which again reproduced this dichotomy. And that came now from American diplomats who served in Romania as diplomats in the past 20 or 25 years. And they wrote a letter, addressed it to the Romanian population, warning us that we have to choose between United States and Russia. So by now it's not Europe versus Russia, but United States, Russia. And they say that if Simeon will be elected, then this will have strong negative effects in what regards the American support for Romania, economic and military as well.
Interesting. Even under the Trump administration that's going on.
Strangely enough. Yeah, and they are both Democrats and Republican diplomats who signed this letter. So the game of you know, blaming and stigmatizing and warning and economic interest is a very dynamic political game, actually.
Right, and it cuts across various different interests and positions. Specifically on the Ukrainian war, I mean, Romania has a quite pivotal position insofar as Ukrainian grain passes through Romania, or Romanian waters on its way out, and Western arms have been passing through Romania on its way into Ukraine. What has been Romanian population as a whole's response to the Ukrainian war? How has it polarized, if at all, over the war?
Well, this is a very complicated matter, and it has several dimensions. For example, the refugees from Ukraine who entered to Romania at the beginning of the Russian invasion of Ukraine generated ambiguous reactions. So there was a strong wave of solidarity and support for them as war refugees. But on the other hand, and after a while, when the precarious people learned that these war refugees actually gain a lot of support from the Romanian state in money, in jobs, in housing, then, you know, the wave of or another type of reaction to this also occurred, like being against the Ukrainian immigrants, you know. And then there were the economic, maybe we can refer here to the impact on the energy prices, gas, and also electricity, which increased a lot, starting with 2020, you know. Yeah, because obviously Romania had to be part of the European Union's initiative to gain independence from Russian gas. This supposedly had also an impact on increasing the energy prices. Nevertheless, this moment, politically speaking, was manipulated to hide the fact that actually the liberalization of energy prices started earlier, started since 2010-2012, actually resulted in the increase of these energy prices, you know. And then, okay, what happened? Again, I guess in order to assure a kind of social peace around these issues, the government offered support for the population, like 60% of the costs of electricity and gas consumption was paid by the state. To whom? To the private and public energy companies. So it was not a regularization of energy prices, but they kept the very high prices and actually subsidized the energy companies. And actually, this was one of the reasons why Romania became so indebted, I guess. I mean, I fear, because of these spendings, governmental spendings for sharing the profit of the energy companies, as they actually did even before during pandemic. So offering state aid and subventions to companies to save them from the impact of the pandemic and to save the whole capitalist economy, actually. So, yeah, in a way, the war in Ukraine had these impacts. And then the third maybe matter to mention in terms of armament, you know, so even before the start of the war in Ukraine, Romania purchased a lot of missiles and the so-called Patriot systems from United States. They signed in 2020 a contract for 7 systems of Patriot missiles. For a cost of $4 billion American dollars. And in 2024, one of the systems was donated to Ukraine by Romania, which actually resulted in contracts with United States. So in this sense too, the war had an impact on the Romanian economy and governmental spending and the governmental indebtedness and public deficit that kills us nowadays.
Very good. You write, or here I paraphrase from your writing, that you have privatization, all the kind of neoliberal package implemented in Romania, which has been done by the neoliberals themselves, the national liberals, as well as the participation of the social democrats. You've got right-wing anti-state parties who self-define as anti-system, but also want to privatize public service and dismantle the state through an anti-corruption fight. And you've got a progressive left that forgets about the working class and defines itself as radical by supporting sexual freedoms and environmentalist demands, and a civil society dominated by a depoliticized NGOism. That's a pretty desolate picture, a picture that's probably not unfamiliar to our listeners elsewhere, whether they're in North America, Western Europe, or elsewhere. But the context of Romania, and particularly in terms of living standards, makes it perhaps felt that much more acutely. How do Romanians understand then the past 35 years?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, obviously there is an official discourse about the past 35 years, which considers that this was the most prosperous period of Romania, economically speaking, and also a period when political freedoms and civic rights were assured for the population, including the right to freely circulate in the European Union at the point after 2007 particularly. So there is this very pink picture of capitalist transformations, which forgets and wants to hide actually all the negative effects of privatization, marketization, liberalization, financialization processes in the past 35 years. And again, actually all the traditional political parties were participating in the political decisions which actually formed capitalism in Romania, market economy and all the others. They tried to fulfill all conditions which the European Union put in terms of respecting these conditions to integrate into the Union. And also, I don't know, World Bank and International Monetary Fund, which also had their conditions for loans. And all these conditions were about privatization and creation of market economy. And very many people, starting with the 1990s, lost their jobs because after privatization, the factories were mostly, majority of factories were closed, unemployment increased, inflation increased, prices increased. And a lot of people started to go abroad for looking for better jobs, or any jobs, actually. They were not necessarily better because, well, they liked protection and, well, all kinds of disadvantages that immigrant workers usually encounter. So, so this was the effect, one of the major effects of capitalist transformations. And then those who remained, actually, yeah, the high rates of poverty among the population. We still have like 22% of people living in poverty and social exclusion. We also have a very high rate of poverty among people who are employed. So being employed is actually not a guarantee of getting out of poverty, due to the fact that for a long period of time, and even now, not so much, but still we have this legacy, Romania was sold on the international market as a country of cheap labor force. So very low salaries. These low salaries, for example, I mean, the minimum income, for example, in last year and this year, and well, like always, this level of minimum income, which now is around 800 euro net amount, was always below the cost of consumption goods. at the minimum decent level, you know. And there were also high level of income inequalities and other inequalities between the population. Yeah, so all these negative processes were in the spirit of neoliberal ideology explained by, you know, mistakes made by people themselves, or claiming that only those were in poverty who did not work enough or who are lazy and they don't really deserve to have a better life because they could not actually adapt to the requirements of this capitalist way of life. So it's not only that these divisions were created economically, as I said, but also ideologically. They were reproduced. And people who were losers of these transformations, not due to their personal characteristics, but due to how the capitalist system and exploitation and dispossession works, they were also blamed of being nostalgic of Ceausescu, of communism. And this fueled a very, and also reflects a very strong anti-communist position today, which is very widespread. And even now, when we have this right-wing candidate, Nicu Șordan, and the extreme-right candidate, George Simion, both of them and the other political actors and intellectuals and media suggest us that there is no alternative. There's no third alternative to these two. So you have to choose either a right-wing neoliberal policymaker or an extremist who will also make the cuts which will be necessary, who will also spend money for militarization because that's a must in the European Union. In addition, he is a nationalist and extremist in this sense. And these suggestions, there is no third way, because the third way would be socialism, internationalist socialism, which is very much attacked by both directions. So in this sense, the right wing and the extreme wing are very much partnering into excluding, even from our political imaginaries, the possibility of an alternative to capitalism.
So is there any nostalgia for the socialist past in Romania? On this podcast, we've talked before about Yugo-nostalgia in the states, the successor states of Yugoslavia, Ostalgie in Germany, etc. Is that not found in Romania as much as in some of these other places?
I don't know if we can call it nostalgia. It's the position according to which there were many things during state socialism that were better for the many. I mean, access to public housing, guaranteeing a secure job, free healthcare, free education, school education, and so on and so forth. Because all these of socialism were actually lost. So it's not a nostalgia in a sense of, you know, wanting necessarily the dictatorial Ceausescu back
sure.
to the political scene, but idea or this legacy of experiencing an alternative or another possible way of doing things. And
so I just interrupt. I asked because I recalled also a recent episode from last year with Volodymyr Ishchenko, who commented that actually what you find in Ukraine today is not even so much nostalgia, because it's from people from younger generations who didn't even experience state socialism, but young people who are kind of latching onto some idea of that as a way of, or as some vision of an alternative, as you put it. Is that something that you find in Romania?
Yeah, exactly. So we have youngsters who speak more freely about these ideas than the old generations, who maybe they are afraid that they will be stigmatized by being or wanting to bring back Ceausescu. So, and what concerns us, some of us who define our political position as socialist internationalist political position, our argument is for, you know, for thinking about a socialist alternative to capitalism, which would use the socialist legacy in the sense of having some models of making economy, running production and having means of production in public ownership, having housing in public ownership. But obviously, for socialism for the 21st century and after all these changes of capitalism, the socialism that we envision should be different than the one. So we don't want to return to the past, but look forward for the future. But the majority says this is utopia, this is unrealistic. Now you have to choose among a right-wing and an extreme right-wing candidate, and you necessarily have to choose for the right-wing one. This is what comes up also from the left, from the social democrat or the progressive left, if you wish to call so, in order because they say this is the emergency. And if this threatening moment will pass, then we will discuss about the rest. But usually this is how things happen. You never
So there's that sort of
big problems, but you always have an emergency, and then things as usual in capitalism will continue.
Right. I mean, you have this sort of popular front or anti-fascist sort of politics, which says we have to exclude the radical right, vote for the establishment parties, and then the same process repeats itself again in the future. I wanted to ask, maybe close off, to ask you about housing struggles in Romania, in which you're an activist, and why you think that's an important point of intervention to make in political and social life today.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, we are some housing activists who are also militant researchers. So when we were, and we are thinking about solutions to the housing crisis in Romania, then we, being also socialists, we try to imagine a solution which would be a kind of transitional program towards the socialist alternative to capitalism. Or to make it more simple, actually what we claim, and this is our political vision, the need to extract as much residential units from the market as possible, and to increase at least to a parity public housing stock, which actually assures housing accessibility for the many, regardless of their income. Because what is happening now is actually that in Romania, that almost the whole housing sector functions through the market. And this means the private production, usually by real estate developers of private housing, you know, also the emergence of private rental sector. We don't have a very developed private sector due to our historical housing policies and past dependencies. But in the big cities, we have this housing unaffordability crisis. So even people who earn an overage income, they have to spend more than 40% of their income to housing costs. And we consider that this is not acceptable. And also we have phenomenon of forced evictions against which, again, we try to against which we try to organize. But most importantly, these are the two big pillars, our struggle for increasing public housing and also for the private renters. And again, this we think that it could be part of the of a longer perspective vision about how capitalism should be changed towards a socialist alternative. And yeah, we don't have much time here. Yeah, actually, we had a particular housing system during state socialism, obviously based on a centralized economy and public financial regime, which facilitated the production of public housing. So what we also say that the solution of the housing problems that were created by capitalism cannot be solved within capitalism.
All right, very good. I think we will leave that there. Thank you very much, Eniku. This has been, I think, very enlightening as to Romanian politics.
Thank you very much for inviting me. And hopefully this will also get to a larger public, which can learn about Romania, not good things and good news, but at least put Romania on the map of global politics.